content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, a book review, The Genius of Handel's Messiah by Jan Swafford. Among the pedestaled titans of Western music, George Friedrich Handel was the first composer whose work not only quickly became celebrated in his own time, but has been heralded ever since. Before Handel, no real repertoire of enduring music had existed. Composers were considered craftsmen in an evanescent art, their creations regularly superseded by fresher work. Most music that got performed was relatively new. Claudio Monteverdi, the preeminent European composer of the early 17th century, was largely forgotten within decades of his death in 1643. Johann Sebastian Bach amounted to hardly more than a cult figure after he died in 1750, his major works unplayed well until the next century. When Handel died at 74 in 1759, he was already fortified for posterity. A celebrity since his 20s, he had been subject of grand portraits and was depicted as Orpheus in a 1738 statue in London's Vauxhall Gardens. Whereas Bach earned an unmarked grave in Leipzig and one obituary 4 years after he died, Handel was buried in Westminster Abbey. Handel stands apart in another way from the musical giants who have been rediscovered and enshrined. Each of them is renowned for an array of often performed pieces. His stature is owed above all to a single work, the Oratorio Messiah. Among the towering masterpieces of Western music, the Messiah occupies a distinctive place. It is familiar to more people than any other work of its kind. Bach's B minor Mass and St. Matthew Passion and Monteverdi's Vespers are comparable among supreme choral pieces, but they aren't performed at your church or your high school down the street. The Messiah often is, trotted out during the Christmas season by amateur and professional choruses around the globe. A fair percentage of the world probably knows the Hallelujah Chorus well enough to sing along. This skewed acclaim is unfair to Handel, who was as brilliantly prolific as any composer who ever lived. But it is also a tribute to the overwhelming effect of the Messiah, which is a feat-sustained inspiration arguably unsurpassed in the canon of Western music. Comfort ye, my people, the libretto begins, pulling us in at the beginning, its flow of compelling melody and choruses enthralling us for the next 2 hours and leaving us singularly exalted. Reasons for the Messiah's enduring power are manifold, though certainly they begin with the music itself, which manages to join the lofty and the populist, as does all of Handel's work. In every valley, the desperate lives and troubled times that made Handel's Messiah, Charles King takes his cue from the oratorio's ability to convey, era after era, a transporting sense of that something cosmic and profound was at stake, even when the cares of this world happened to intrude. King, who embarked on the book during the pandemic, found renewed comfort in the Messiah's arc, especially its message of hope in difficult times, starting with those first words, "Comfort ye." He also felt moved to rediscover the Messiah's sheer weirdness by exploring its origins in the murkier currents of what is remembered as the Age of Reason. King, a professor of international affairs and government at Georgetown University, and a splendid writer, has made a specialty of popular cultural history. A meticulous researcher, he delivers surprises, and his prologue is one of them. Some days he would wander the manor house in a blank stupor, barely able to lift a foot. He was so afraid of the cold that he lay under 6 blankets in winter and four in summer. He never married, fathered no children, and made distant enemies more readily than close friends. These fine and vivid sentences are not, as the reader expects, about Handel. They are about his exquisitely odd and obsessive acolyte, Charles Jennens, the Messiah's libertist, a figure few listeners are aware of. King proceeds to relay more about Jennens' inner life and creative struggles than about Handel's, of which first-hand reports are skimpy. Jennens' story is indeed fascinating. A rich squire and crabbly conservative political dissident, he was emotionally tormented but still managed to be a significant art collector, Shakespeare scholar, and patron of music. King's resurrection of Jennens' crucial role, laboring in private over a libretto that he hoped would inspire the prodigious, as he called Handel, to new musical heights, helps illuminate how unusual Handel's oratorio was and remains. Here is the weirdness that King emphasizes. An oratorio is essentially an unstaged opera, a story told in music. The Messiah is a collection of gnomic scriptural passages that are prophetic in import but offer no story at all. It has nothing that could be called a plot, King observes. Its form is more like that of a found poem, built from Bible verses that have been rearranged and, here and there, edited by a depressive man struggling to find his way toward hope and return to a pre-Enlightenment vision of religion. Jennens, for whom faith and kingship were imbued with mystery, endorsed the legitimacy of the disposed Stuart monarchy and rejected the rational deist perspective. For his part, Handel, a generally agreeable though fiercely proud man, witty and gluttonous and gouty, and given to polylingual swearing, was probably indifferent to such political and sectarian matters, but he knew a good librettist when he saw one. The form of King's book is like an intricate collage, gathering very different characters around the goal of concentrating on the surround, the context. Not all of the figures directly connect to Handel, and at times King's deep background verges on the tangential. But the similar storyline links his cast of characters. They are coping with dire predicaments in a time of political flux and fear, all of them managing to carry on a spirit of perseverance that runs through the Messiah. For example, King delves at length into the outlandish marital travails of the contralto Susanna Cyber, whom Handel turned to as he rounded up singers for the Messiah premiere in 1742 in Dublin, a propitious conversion for both. We learn, as a scandalized public did, all about her husband's outrageous abusiveness, her lover's and family's efforts to protect her, the two lawsuits her husband filed against the lover. Cyber's well-known suffering lent her musical lamentations in the oratorio a raw power. "He was despised and rejected of men," she sang, "a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief." For a stunned opening night audience, and in many of her performances after. Other lives and issues are more peripherally entangled in King's tale of the Messiah's emergence. A distressing chapter on the British slave trade, to which Handel had a minor financial connection, features an African Muslim named Ayuba Diallo, who ends up enslaved in Maryland. Against all odds, he ultimately succeeds in returning to Bundu in West Africa. His episodic journey includes an interlude in London, where it would not have been unusual to see Diallo walking past Jennison's townhouse in Queen Square, though who knows if the two ever met. Several times in his absorbing narrative, King reaches for these sorts of indirect associations. And what about Handel's evolution, personal and musical? After all, he is the composer who made the Messiah, even if he didn't do it alone or have the originating idea for it. Handel sometimes gets a bit lost along the way in every valley. After a well-stocked chapter about the oratorio and its premiere, King understandably he isn't a musician or musicologist, doesn't devote much space to exploring the particulars of Handel's style and reputation, or the special place of Messiah in his work as a whole. The compositions that Handel churned out at a remarkable rate were simultaneously demand-driven and distinctive, convention-bound and transcendent. Working within the musical language of his time, he could conjure any effect, dancingly, energetic, profound, aristocratic, folksy, eerie, heart-filling, comic. He could do it all, and he had an uncanny sense of how to grab an audience. Few could work faster. That Handel wrote the Messiah in 24 days has long stirred talk of divine inspiration, though in fact he was known to turn out a three-hour opera in 3 weeks. Some have speculated that he was manic-depressive and wrote when he was manic. Indisputably, his speed was abetted by liberal borrowing from his own work and generous pilfering from other composers. 4 Messiah choruses are lifted from his earlier pieces, none of them sacred. About his plagiarisms, Handel was unapologetic, saying more or less that those people didn't know what to do with their stuff. He wasn't wrong. Handel was an enthusiastic copier, was also a pioneer in developing the English oratorio. Born in Halle, Germany in 1685, he settled in England in 1712 and concentrated on the genre of Italian opera seria, a London craze whose popularity later faded. Facing bankruptcy by the 1730s, Handel revived his career by turning from seria, courtly entertainment stuffed with mannered drama, to the pared-down English oratorio. Making use of his operatic skills and dramatic instincts, he transfigured this new musical genre with results that most choral composers you could name, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, are manifestly indebted to. By contrast, the artificiality of his operas, the major part of his output, has kept them from becoming repertory staples. In all of his work, Handel was among the greatest, the most irresistible of tunesmiths. Like Bach, he believed in a union of word, meaning, and music. To that end, Bach often pursued esoteric symbolism and numerology, with vocal lines crossing in music when Christ is mentioned, and the like. Handel wanted his illustrations to be more on the sleeve. The land brought forth frogs, the soprano sings in his oratorio Inside Israel in Egypt, to an accompaniment that is hopping, hopping, hopping. When the chorus proclaims there came all manner of flies, the strings break out in buzzing. In those places, Handel plays the plagues of Egypt for laughs, but he does the same kind of thing in earnest in the Messiah. Every valley shall be exalted, the tenor sings in a robustly rising line, which sinks for, and every mountain and hill made low. Then the crooked, jagged line, straight, held note, and rough places, jagged again, plain, long-held note. Each word and image of the text is painted like this. Meanwhile, you hear Handel lifting the music to mighty climaxes over and over, and it never gets old. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, the chorus sings, tossing that bit back and forth in dancing counterpoint. What Beethoven, who considered Handel his only musical superior, particularly admired, was his ability to get dazzling effects with simple means. As both composers knew, simple is hard. Among the possibly apocryphal stories about Handel, one has him commenting to his servant upon finishing the Hallelujah chorus, "I did think I did see all heaven before me, and the great God himself seated on his throne with his company of angels." In fact, nothing indicates that he considered the Messiah his magnum opus at the time, or expected that this piece would be his ticket to immortality. Famous though he was, Handel was still a jobbing composer, and composers had never been endowed with an immortal aura. Yet he was eager to share an awestruck response to the Dublin premiere. As King reports, Handel wrote a letter a few months after the event, enclosing an Irish bishop's verdict, "The whole is beyond anything I had a notion of till I read and heard it. the cleric reported. It seems to be a species of music different from any other. The letter was to Jennings, the Messiah's librettist. Handel wanted him to know how well Your Messiah was received in that country. One of the most inspired composers of all time might have been aware, in some sense, that he had transcended himself, but he could not claim to understand the alchemy that had worked this wonder. In the spirit of his oratorio, the goal of his letter to Jennings seems to have been not to blow his own horn, but to give comfort to his companion in the endeavor. Our next story, The Broken Promise of USB-C, by Ian Bogost. Can we talk about cables in our lives? I'll start. I have a circa 2020 iPhone, which features a lightning port for charging. My monitor, laptop, and e-reader all have ports for USB-C, the connector that looks like a pill. My car has USB-A, which is the older, rectangular design that is somehow always upside down. My fancy webcam uses something called micro HDMI, which is not the same as mini HDMI or standard HDMI, and to get it to work with my computer, I have to plug its cable into a pair of daisy-chained adapters. If I upgraded to the newest iPhone, which uses USB-C, I'd be somewhat better off. But what about my family and all of their devices with different ports? Let them eat cable, I suppose. This chaos was supposed to end with USB-C as our savior. The European Union even passed a law to make the port the charging standard by the end of this year. I do not live in Europe, and you might not either, but the requirement helped push Apple, which has long insisted on its own proprietary plugs, to get on board. As part of that transition, Apple just put USB-C connectors in its wireless mice and keyboards, which previously used Lightning. People think the shape of the plug is the only thing that matters in a cable. It does matter. If you can't plug the thing in, it's useless. In fact, a bunch of cables that look the same with matching plugs that fit the same size holes may all do different things. This is the second circle of our cable hell. My USB-C may not be the same as yours, and the USB-C you bought 2 years ago may not be the same as the one you got today. I am unfortunately old enough to remember when the first form of USB was announced and then launched. The problem this was meant to solve was the same one as today's, a rat's nest of cords, cables, and wires. But then it evolved. USB 1.1, 2.0, 3.0, USB 4, then irrationally USB 4 2.0. Some of these cords and their corresponding ports look identical, but had different capabilities for transferring data and power devices. I can only gesture to the depth of absurdity that was soon attained without boring you to tears and lapsing into my own despair. Muddled charging capabilities are not particular to the Thunderbolt standard of Apple. If you have ever plugged a perfectly USB-ish USB cable into a matching USB power brick and found that your device doesn't charge or takes forever to do so, that's because the amount of current your brick provides might not be supported by the USB-shaped cable and its corresponding USB standard, or it might be weaker than your device requires. Such details are usually printed on the brick in writing so tiny nobody can read it. But even if you could, you would still know what it means, like some kind of USB savant. This situation is worsened by the fact that many manufacturers now ship devices without a charging brick. A lack of standardization is not the problem here. The industry has designed, named, and rolled out a parade of standards that pertain to USB and all its cousins. Some of those standards live inside of other standards. The variations stretch on and on. Hope persists that someday eventually this hell can be escaped, and that, given sufficient standardization, regulatory intervention, and consumer demand, a winner will emerge in the battle of the plugs. But the dream of having a universal cable is always and forever doomed, because cables, like humankind itself, are subject to the curse of time, the most brutal standard of them all. At any given moment, people use devices they bought last week alongside those they've owned for years. They use old plugs in rental cars and or airport gate lounge seats. They buy new gadgets with even better capabilities that demand new and different, if similar looking, cables. Even Apple, now putting a USB-C port in every new device, and so does every other manufacturer. That doesn't mean that they will do everything you expect the cables to do in the future. Back in 1988, the Times told me, if you make your move to USB now, you can be sure your new devices will have a port to plug into. I was ready. I'm still ready. But alas, a port to plug into has never been enough. Our third article, Enhance Your Mood with Schopenhauer's Playlist by Arthur C. Brooks. The 19th century philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer believed that the truth about life is largely invisible to humans. What we perceive around us is mostly a set of illusions, while reality, the inner essence of the world, as he conceived it, is generally out of our grasp. Yet he believed in one oracle that could reveal the secret verities: listening to music. Schopenhauer's theory was that the will is so ineffable that the nonverbal language of music alone could grant access to the apprehension of reality. Music thus opened a unique channel of higher consciousness. Though Schopenhauer was an atheist, his conception bears strong resemblance to the idea held by many thinkers who find in music the language of the divine. For example, the American Catholic scholar Peter Kreeft wrote in a 1989 book, Three Philosophies of Life, that God is love and music is the language of love, therefore music is the language of God. I'm not an expert in academic debate about the metaphysics of music, but I do find this notion very suggestive, and it captures for me the experiences I can't access in any other way. I learned to read music at the age of 5 and spent all of my 20s as a professional classical musician. Like many musicians, I am synesthetic. Different pitches and chords evoke in my brain colors and even smells. These sensory effects make listening to or playing a great composition into an experience beyond the greatest fireworks on earth. Your experience of music may be a bit more well-grounded than mine. Fair enough. But Schopenhauer was on to something. We have plenty of evidence that music truly is one of the greatest ways to understand life more deeply. Music has appeared in every human society for which ethnographic evidence exists. According to research by a top scholar at Harvard's Music Lab, music is enmeshed with all of the important areas of our experience, from sweet lullabies to sappy love songs to hymns of religious praise. Although styles of music vary greatly around the world, the making and appreciation of music are such ubiquitous parts of human life that it can seem as much a phenomenon of our nature as a product of our culture. Indeed, our brains are built to enjoy music, as scientists showed in a 2018 study conducted through the Berkeley Music and Health Institute. We're even hardwired to use music to help us heal. For example, when the brains of patients with Parkinson's disease are stimulated by hearing a rhythmic piece such as a march, their symptoms may diminish and they are able to walk more naturally. Alzheimer's patients who can't remember family members typically are nonetheless able to recognize familiar songs. And people suffering from epilepsy can experience a dramatic decrease in seizures when listening to certain kinds of classical music, the so-called Mozart effect. Over the past two decades, neuroscientists have also conducted experiments on the effects of music upon human emotions. The research findings on which genres of music bring the most happiness are inconclusive. One study found, based on characteristics of harmony, structure, and rhythm, that the world's happiest song is the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations. You might ask why someone would want to listen to miserable music, but obviously we do. You have very likely listened to sad songs after a bad breakup, and at some point, the function of sad music is not only to soothe you. Scholars also find that when people suffering from negative emotions consume disconsolate music, it helps them understand their feelings and find meaning in them. A sad song can help you feel less alone in your sadness and make sense of it. In general, music amplifies positive and negative emotions most under two circumstances. First, when it's performed live. British researchers asked participants to listen to classical music in three ways: live, pre-recorded, and in an MTV-style video. Using sensors attached to the subjects' scalps, the scholars detected significantly more brain activity for the in-person performance, indicated that this elicited the most engagement and focus in the listeners. If you want to use music more strategically to heighten your emotional experiences and gain a deeper sense of meaning and self-understanding, here are a few ideas to consider. 1. Decide what music you want, what you want from your music. The research indicates that a trade-off takes place between using music to bond socially and using it to intensify emotions. If you want the former result, listen with friends. If you want the latter outcome, listen by yourself. If you want a mixture of both, try going to a live concert with your friends. 2. Follow a recipe. The effects of music depend to a large extent on its underlying ingredients. For example, the music that typically elicits the most positive emotion has a fast tempo, between 140 and 150 beats per minute, features chords that include the seventh tone to create a sense of expectation, or is familiar to you. You could go study at the local conservatory to learn more about these elements, but the shortcut is just to create a catalog of songs you like. Pay attention to how each one makes you feel and write down its characteristics in your own words. Then look for patterns. 3. Learn and grow. Thinking about your music in terms of its effects on you will probably increase your appetite for new genres and help your tastes become more sophisticated. Once you start getting interested in increasing the emotional and cognitive effects of love songs, say, you might want to cultivate an interest in Italian opera. If you like how an electric guitar shredding sick riffs simulates your limbic system, try taking that experience to the next level with a flamenco virtuoso such as Paco de Lucia. 4. Play it yourself. Among professional and amateur musicians, opinions differ about whether emotional experiences and life understanding are deeper when playing music as opposed to merely listening to it. Personally, I find listening better, but this may be influenced by having played in symphony orchestras. In fact, many musicians, including amateurs, find a kind of ecstasy in playing. One 2020 study looked at the well-being of the effects of playing music and found them to be significant and positive. If you do the work, you too can make music a part of your life that goes beyond a pleasant background and becomes a lifelong journey into higher levels of consciousness and self-awareness. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.